So hello students, we are now going to look at chapter 6 where we will discuss the various acts that lead to employee benefits. In this we are going to look at the Provident Fund Act, the Minimum Wage Payment Act and a few other acts. So let's look at the objectives. So as mentioned earlier, by the end of this chapter you are going to understand about the Provident Fund Act of 1952, the Minimum Wages Act of 1948, the Payment of Wages Act of 1948, and the Payment of the Bonus Act from 1965. So as I had mentioned in an earlier discussion, to make the lives of employees simpler and to enhance their lifestyle, there are certain acts which have been brought about by every government around the world. As India received its independence in the year 1947, we were in the second industrial revolution, or Industry 2.0, where there was mass production, there were factories which were coming up, and we needed employees to robustly kind of industrialize our nation. So hence these acts were introduced so that there would be equality and fairness for the employees working in those industries. So let's go ahead and look at these particular acts. As is customary, we will look at the introductory slides first. So traditionally, the Indian governments at the federal, that is the central and the state level, have sought to ensure a high degree of protection for the workers. But in practice, legislative rights only cover a minority of workers. So again, these are subject to limitations, conditions, laws, and these need to be understood well. Workers who sought better conditions and trade unions who campaigned through the strike action were frequently and violently suppressed. So even though there have been laws into existence, we can also see that many a times they were, the workers were suppressed. Indian labor law makes a distinction between people who worked in organized sectors and people working in unorganized sectors. India's labor laws underwent a major update in the Industrial Disputes Act of 1947. So when India got independent, we tried to look at and focus into various areas where we could reduce conflict, reduce layoffs, and give the workers the right correct conditions to work in. So this particular Disputes Act of 1947 was duly enacted to provide for the investigation and settlement of industrial disputes. Now, what are industrial disputes? They're nothing but the conflicts that arise between the unions, okay, and the management. So a lot of organizations today are unionized to protect the rights of the laborers, and hence there might be disputes or there might be differences in perspectives which lead to conflict. Now, this law prevents illegal strikes and lockouts. It also is intended to provide relief to the workmen during layoff or after retrenchment or wrongful dismissal. So this particular term we have discussed in detail in the earlier chapter. Since then, an additional 45 national laws expand or intersect with the 1948 Act, and another 200 state laws control the relationships between the worker and the company. So a person who is involved in industrial relations or human relations has to be aware of the internal workings of such laws. Now we will look at what goes under the Employee Provident Funds and Miscellaneous Act of 1952. So Employee Provident Funds and Miscellaneous Provisions Act 1952 came into effect on 4th March of 1952 by the Government of India administered by Central Board of Trustees or CBT, in short. In this, all the activities are being operated by the Central Provident Fund Commissioner, presided by the Union Labour Minister of India. This act is an important fragment of labour welfare legislation enacted by the Parliament to provide social security benefits to workers. So as I mentioned in the introductory slide, it's an endeavour by the government to provide a sort of an equity or a fairness so that the workers are not exploited by the capitalist industrialists. So at present, the act and schemes framed provide three types of benefits. One is the contributory provident fund, which we have understood in the last chapter. Pension benefits to employees and family members, which has again been covered earlier, and insurance cover to the members of the provident fund, which has again been covered in the last chapter in detail. Let's look at the applicability of this specific law. So all establishments employing 20 or more persons, okay, in the case of cinema theaters, it's 5 or more, are brought under the purview of the Employee Provident Fund Act from the very first date of setup and are subjected to fulfillment of other conditions. So this is what is important to understand. Now, from the perspective of availing pension benefit, a specific member under this particular act should have completed 10 years of continuous service or attained age of 50 years or more, does not receive any EPF pension, and will receive pension amount on a monthly basis after attaining an age of 58. Let's look at the administrative charges. The administrative charges in the Employee Provident Fund Act include: employer who has to pay administrative charges at 1.1% of emoluments towards the Provident Fund charges and 0.01 towards ELDI scheme. The employee need not contribute anything towards these charges. A member is eligible to apply for withdrawing his provident fund and pension fund only after 2 months from the date of resignation, provided that he or she is not employed during the said 2 months. For example, let's consider the employee, you know, XYZ, who is working or who's been working for an organization for the last 40 years. So they joined at an early age of 20 and have been working. So they have been working in a theater. Okay. So there's a renowned theater in probably Bangalore, and this gentleman has been working for a good 40 years there. Now they are retiring at an age of 60 and they have to withdraw. So these are the conditions that will be put on to the employee. Yeah. Now, what are some of the problems faced in withdrawing or transferring the employee provident fund money, and what are some of the remedies? So one of the important problems may be the mismatch of the signature of the member. So if this happens, they need to inform the provident fund office through their employer or generate a fresh application and submit it to that office. There can also be a chance of a mismatch of the account number. So in some cases, if the account number is wrong, then the application is returned to the employer. In this case, the employee corrects the details and gets it countersigned from the employers. Otherwise, it becomes difficult to process their funds. Another important problem that people might face is incorrect bank details that are furnished by the member. Now, this is a logical process, right? So if you have to get a refund of your tax, or if you're liable for a pension or an employee provident fund, and if current bank details or correct bank details are not provided, then the fund may not get transferred. So correct details filled with respect to account number, name of the bank, branch address, and the MICR code, which is the MICR code of the bank, has to be provided in a correct manner. If anything is going wrong, then the person may not become eligible, or it may become a problem. Now we look at the advances of the PF account. So members are eligible to withdraw the money as advances from their PF accounts for purposes like marriage, education, medical treatment, etc. This is tax and interest free. So sometimes, like, you have an LIC, okay, this is similar to if you have had an LIC policy for long, and it's an endowment policy which will give you, you know, returns after 20 years, you are after a period of time entitled to take a loan on that particular policy, and similar can be done for the PF account. Okay, now let's make a conclusion for this particular act. Thus, the Employment Provident Fund Act provides grant of impunity from operation of schemes framed under the Act to an establishment or a class of employees and to an individual on given conditions. The second aspect is penalties to employers or trustees of exempted provident fund who contravenes the provision of the Act. The next one is appointment of inspector to secure compliance under the Act and schemes framed thereunder, and mode of recovery of money which is right from the employers. So this Act is created or articulated to create a sort of a savings fund which helps the employee post-retirement, or as you can see, a loan can be taken on the same. Now we will look at the Employees Provident Fund and Miscellaneous Act rules. Okay, so there are certain new rules which go to the, you know, last year, which is 2021, and this relates to the latest amendments that are done. So in the financial bill of 2021, they have introduced one of the key amendments to the EPF Act, which we have discussed. Now, amendment basically relates to a specific change. So that amendment is enforced from the 1st of April 2021 onwards. The interest on any contribution above 2.5 lakhs by an employee to a recognized provident fund is taxable. So if they are pushing higher amounts in provident fund, then they are liable to a tax from the government. Until the financial year of 2020 to 2021, the income, the interest income earned on contribution to the EPF made by the employee was completely tax-free. So this is a critical change which must be understood by employees. Now let's look at the components of the EPF account. So employee's contribution, or your contribution, is 12% towards EPF. So this amount goes directly into the EPF account and is not provided as a cash component to you. Now, towards EPS is an 8.33%, towards EPF is 3.67%, and towards EDLI is that 8.5%, 0.5% here, which is the employer's contribution, that is your company's contribution. Yeah, so this is how the provident fund account is segregated. Now, below are the new EPF rules that we need to understand. So earlier, you know, last year or in the year of 2020, the EPFO had allowed its members to withdraw COVID-19 advance to meet exigencies due to the pandemic. So whatever problems on a financial note were encountered, so the employees could withdraw their provident fund from this context. also to support its subscribers during the second wave of the pandemic, which happened in the year 2021, the EPFO has now allowed its members to avail second non-refundable COVID-19 advances. So these are certain things which are done by the government to support people in difficult times. Another rule that the EPF members need to know is that the members are allowed to withdraw 3 months' basic wages, okay, that is basic pay plus the earnest allowance, or up to 75% of amount standing to their credit in their provident fund account, subject to whichever is less. Now we will look at the Minimum Wages Act of 1948. Now let's first understand the objective of this act. To fix minimum rates of wages in certain categories of employments and industries. So the government has played the part of an enforcer to see whether the employees, especially the blue-collared workers and the contractual workers or the operators, are not exploited. The applicability of the act is also discussed here. So the act will be applicable to certain schedule of employment in respect to which minimum rate of wages have been fixed by the act. It is applicable to employees directly employed or employed through contractors in such schedule of industry. Let's look at the concept of fixation of minimum rates of wages under this particular act of 1948. So the appropriate government to fix minimum rates of wages from time to time for various industries and schedules of employment. So as the years progress, there will be specific changes in the due course of these minimum rates so that these can accommodate aspects like rate in the interest, you know, the changes in the interest rates when you're availing loans, also the element of inflation, which leads to the, you know, increase in the rates of the foods, the rates of the products and services which are availed by the employees. Now let's look at the procedure for fixing and revising of the minimum rates of wages. So the Minimum Wages Act provides for two methods of fixation or revision of minimum wages. Under the committee method, committees and subcommittees are set up by the government to hold inquiries and make recommendations with regard to fixation and revision of minimum wages. So this is one particular method. Minimum rates for piece work is also what we will understand. So not less than the minimum rate wages as fixed is what is a minimum rate for piece work. And there can be aspect of overtime. So for overtime work, the wages to be paid at double the normal rate. So of course, if some person is doing an overtime, let's say a person A is usually in an 8-hour shift and has completed some 12 hours on duty, so that overtime would be 1.5 times, or for agriculture labor. So it should be more than the normal time. There is also a penal provision. For breach of provisions of the Act, the employer shall be punishable with imprisonment up to 6 months so it can either be this or a fine of 500, or it can involve a punishment of 6 months as well as a fine of 500 if there is some sort of breach of the minimum wages. Like let's say the minimum wages of a specific blue-collared worker is 250 rupees per hour, okay? And this is a niche industry and that organization only pays 180 rupees. So this will be a breach and the owner can be legally liable under this provision. Now let's look at the maintenance of registers and records. So quick enlistment here. So annual returns Register for overtime, register of wages, wages slip and master roll should be maintained by organizations. Let's look at the summary of this particular act. So minimum wages rates in India are fixed under this Act of 1948. Since labor is a concurrent subject under the Indian Constitution, minimum wage rates are determined both by the central and the provincial governments. Minimum wage is announced for 45 scheduled employments in the central sphere, while the state level minimum wage is determined by every state, keeping in view the sectors that are more dominant in the state. Minimum wage is revised while considering the following elements: 3 consumption units per earner, minimum food requirement of 2700 calories per average adult, cloth requirement of 72 yards per annum per family, house rent corresponding to the minimum area provided under the government's industrial housing scheme. So this set of needs or elements have been specified under the Minimum Wages Act of 1948. So let us also understand why have a minimum wage. In fact, if you've observed in our earlier chapters, we have discussed the need for a minimum wage as well. So let's revisit this concept. So minimum wage, or MWA, is one of the first laws of independent India, which has been drafted, which has been legislated and enforced in 1948, even before we had a constitution in place. So why was it enacted? So the real reason was to buy peace on behalf of a national burgess that had to manage a working class that was far more militant in those days, but there were other reasons as well. So what this means is, under a national umbrella or a national cause, we had to manage the working class and make them more civilized and make them realize that yes, the government is not going to exploit you like what happened in the pre-independence era. So we had to pacify the workers and we had to ensure that they understand the importance of progressive development in the new industrial era post-independence. So this was the real motive behind, you know, bringing this act into motion. Now there are 3 levels here to this particular Wages Act. The tripartite, meaning the 3-part committee on fair wages appointed in 1948, defined 3 different levels of wages. Now what are these? These are categorized into what is known as a living wage, a fair wage and a minimum wage. Let's look at these in detail. So a living wage is basically what a human being needs to get the basic essentials of food, shelter, clothing, protection against ill health, security for old age, etc. So it's basically the roti, the kapda and the makan, which people aspire, okay, so that they will live a healthy life. The next is the concept of a fair wage. So fair wage is lower than the living wage and takes into account efficiency from the employer's perspective. So let's say if it's not a very niche technology, if it's just some simple loading unloading work, so for that particular work, if the employer has to give some amount which is much higher, then it will not work for them. So in that case, they would be able to pay the worker a fair wage, so which is fair for the work that is being done, and hence it is much lower than the living wage. And finally, there is a minimum wage which is similar to the fair wage, except in 2 respects. It is even lower and has a statutory dimension. So this is like the floor. You cannot go lower than that. So if there is a worker who is unloading a cement sack from a truck and putting it to a specific warehouse, so here the skill level is almost negligible. Okay, any person picked up from the street can do this job as long as they are able-bodied. So in this case, a minimum wage can be proposed, which would be fair for the capitalist or that owner of the business. Now, the resolution passed at the 15th Indian Labour Conference in 1957 mandates taking into account five factors for calculating the minimum wage. Three of them are enlisted here, and the next two would be discussed in our next slide. The first factor is the wage must support three consumption units or three individuals. Food requirement of 2700 calories, which we've seen earlier, and again clothing requirement of 72 yards. So this was, again, we are revisiting this, which we had seen in the graphic earlier. The next one is rent for housing area similar to that provided under the subsidized housing scheme, and of course fuel, lighting and miscellaneous items of expenditure to constitute 20%. So let's suppose a person is living in a city like Pune or a city like Mumbai. So you have to calculate what could be, you know, contributing to expenditures, and can that wage sustain that particular employee. Let's look at the object of this particular act. So the Payment of Wages Act regulates the payment of wages to certain classes of persons employed in the industry, and its importance cannot be underestimated. Now, what this means is that if there is no regulation, then employees would be exploited and would have to really struggle in accomplishing day-to-day activities because of the expenditures associated with living in a town or a city. The Act guarantees payment of wages on time and without any deductions except those that are authorized under. The Act does not apply to persons whose wage is 10,000 or more per month. Now, why would this happen? Because they're already earning much more above what is the minimum wage. So why would this Act then, you know, apply? It would be redundant. The Act also provides to the effect that a worker cannot contract out any right conferred upon him under the Act. Let's now look at the applicability of this particular Act. So factories, industrial establishments, tramway services or motor transport service, air transport service, docks, wharfs or jetties, inland vessels, mines, quarry or oil field plantations, workshops, construction activities or other establishments are covered under this particular Act. In the state of Maharashtra, the Act is extended to shops and commercial establishments as well. Let's look at the coverage aspect of this particular Act. So under coverage of employees, the employees drawing an average wage of up to 10,000 rupees per month are covered, and the time of payment of wages is also covered here. The wages of every person employed to be paid when less than 1,000 persons are employed shall be paid before the expiry of the 7th day of the following month. So this is a mandate under this Act, and when more than 1,000 workers before the expiry of the 10th day of the following month. So wages have to be paid by the employer before either the 7th day or on the 7th day or the 10th day in case of the number of persons. Mode of payment of wages under this Act. So all wages shall be paid in current coins or currency notes or in both. After obtaining the authorization, either by check or by crediting the wages in employee's bank account. And of course, wages exceeding rupees 3000 to be paid by check or through bank, that is applicable in the state of Maharashtra only. Let's look at what are not called as deductions here in this act. So stoppage of increment of the employee, stoppage of the promotion of the employee, stoppage of the incentive lack of performance, demotion of the employee and suspension of employee are not called as deductions here under the Payment of Wages Act of 1948. Let's look at the deductions made by the employer, which should be in accordance with this act only. So the following are said to be the deductions and which are applicable according to this act. So these deductions relate to fines, deductions for absence from duty, deductions for damage to or loss of goods made by the employee due to their negligence, and deductions for house accommodations supplied by the employer or by the government or any housing board for that matter. So these are some of the standard elements of deductions which need to be considered under the Payment of Wages Act of 1948. Now, what are maximum deductions? So the maximum permissible deductions are up to 50% of the wages of the employees. And in the event of deduction, they include payment to cooperative societies. The maximum permissible deduction is 75% of the wages. Now let's look at the Payment of Bonus Act of 1965. So as we've covered from the previous chapter, bonus is a reward that is paid to an employee for his good work towards the organization. The basic objective to give bonus is to share the profit earned by the organization amongst the employees and the staff members. In India, there is a principal law relating to this procedure of payment of bonus to the employees, and that principal law is named as Payment of Bonus Act of 1965. Now, what is the objective of this specific act? To provide statutory rights to the employees to share the profit of the employer. Applicability of the act, it applies to every factory wherein 10 or more persons are employed and other establishments in which 20 or more persons are employed on any day during an accounting year. So this is what is the applicability of this specific act. Now let's look at what industries or establishments are exempted. So exemption for the newly set up establishments. So newly set up establishment is exempted from paying bonus for the first 5 years, provided no profit is made during these years. So this is what we need to understand. So let's consider a startup in the chemical sector. So in a chemical sector, there is a company which is responsible for manufacturing certain organic pigments. Now it's just begun. It has invested about roughly say 55 to 60 lakhs of worth of cost in the infrastructure, in a small a place that they have procured, and they're expected to make a profit after only 6 years. So there's a break even. So they need not pay any bonus to the employees during these years. So if the employer derives profit in any of the first 5 years, then they have to pay bonus. For example, they break even on the fourth year by getting a large assignment and they make sufficient profits. Then in the fifth year, they might want or need to pay a profit under this particular act. Let's look at the eligibility now. So every employee not drawing salary or wages beyond rupees 10,000 per month who has worked for not less than 30 days in an accounting year shall be eligible for bonus for minimum of 8.33% of their respective salary or wages. The first five accounting years following the accounting year in which the employee sells goods or renders services, bonus is payable only in the respect of the accounting year in which profits are made, but the provision for set on and set off wouldn't apply. So this is what one has to be also mindful about. Let's look at the applicability. So the Act is applicable in whole of India where 10 or more workers are working or were working on any day of the preceding 12 months with the aid of power, or whereon 20 or more workers are working or were working on any day of preceding 12 months without the aid of power. So this is what is also important when it comes to applicability of the Payment of Bonus Act of 1965. Let's look at the benefits of this act and the calculation of bonus therein. So minimum bonus is 8.33% of total salary earnings, which is inclusive of the basic pay plus the dearness allowance for the financial year. Now the calculation to be done as if the maximum salary were 3,500 per month, the maximum bonus is 20%. So calculation of bonus, salary or wages and dearness allowance are included while calculating the bonus. However, other allowances such as overtime, house rent, incentive or commission are not included here. The method for calculation of annual bonuses is as follows. Calculate the gross profit in the manner specified in the first schedule in case of a banking company or second schedule in any other case. In case of an employee receiving salary or wages above 2,500, the bonus payable is to be calculated as if the salary or the wages were 2,500 per month only. Now, what is the time limit of payment of bonuses? It is mentioned in the Act that all amounts payable to an employee by the way of bonus are paid in cash. In exemption to where there is dispute regarding payment of bonus pending before an authority within 1 month from the date of which the award becomes enforceable or the settlement comes into operation in respect of such dispute. So students, we have successfully completed chapter number 6, which pertain to the various acts and laws where the employee has, you know, a benefit and should not be exploited. So as mentioned earlier, these pertain to the bonuses, these pertain to the minimum wages, these pertain to the provision of aspects like a provident fund or a gratuity or a pension. So the prime objective here was to reduce the exploitation of the employees. Thank you.